Okay, so this is Standard Model and Beyond lecture number 24. We're continuing on our march toward learning what the magic square and the and triality are, and then what they have to do with the standard model. And so let's just because things get a little bit hairy on this topic, but let me review before. So we'll meet the magic square today. That'll be the main topic. But let's start with a very brief review of the sort of three main characters, the three main types of algebras that are playing a role in the story. Okay, so first of all, we have our norm division algebras. Okay, which you now all know and love, are the real numbers, the complex numbers, the quaternions, and the actonians. Okay, and as we were saying, these are basically the possible types of number systems. Then the other important type is our Lie algebras, or another type, and these are basically the algebra. These are basically the possible symmetry algebras, or generators of symmetry groups. Just like in the norm division algebras where they were classified, and there's only these four R, C, H, and O, in the Lie algebras, they too were classified, and there's only these, three infinite families, S-O-N, S-U-N, S-Q-N, and then five exceptional groups left over, G2, F4, E6, E7, E8. And then finally, we have our three, we have the third type of algebra that we're concerned with, our Jordan algebras. And these are the possible quantum mechanical, these are the algebras of possible quantum mechanical observables. Okay, and now again, in this case, they've been classified. And in this case, well, first there's this kind of infinite class, which is a bit of an outlier, which we call J spin N, the spin factor algebras. But then beyond that, there's a group which fit the same pattern as the above two. There's the Hermitian n by n matrices with elements in the real numbers. There are the Hermitian n by n matrices with elements in the complex numbers, and the Hermitian n by n matrices with elements in the quaternions. And then just like in the previous case, there's one exceptional case left over, which are the Hermitian 3x3 matrices with elements in the octonions. Okay, and then we talked about the symmetries of these algebras. Okay, so we said that the symmetries of the algebras are the automorphisms, the linear maps from the algebra to itself that preserve the product. And the infinitesimal generators of those automorphisms are some derivations which obey this rule that when you apply them to a product of elements in the algebra, the definition of a derivation is that for any two elements x and y in the algebra, if you take their product and then apply the derivation, that's equal to first applying the derivation to the first element and then multiplying by the second element, plus first taking the first element and then multiplying it by the derivation of the second element. Okay, and so we said that for the norm division algebras, for our first category of algebras, the derivations look like this. If you choose any two elements, A and B, that there's a derivation, there's a corresponding derivation of the form DAB, which is like this. It's you first take the commutator of A with B, and then you take the commutator of the result with something, and then you subtract 3 times the associator of A, B, and that same something. So in other words, if we pick any element X now in our norm division algebra and plug it in where the space is there, we map X to a new element in the algebra, DAB of X. And that's the form of the derivation for all of these guys, for all of these norm division algebras. For the Lie algebras, we said, well, in this case, the product is denoted by the Lie bracket, which we write like that. And in this case, now, if we just, for any element of the algebra A, we get a corresponding derivation D sub A, which is where we just take the Lie bracket of any element in the algebra with A. And again, that's a linear map because there's only one in every term. It's a linear map because there's only one space in every term here and also up here. So it just it's ultimately just some matrix that maps any vector X to a new vector X prime in the algebra. And finally, actually, I didn't tell you this last time, but let me tell you it now. The derivations for the Jordan algebras, what do they look like? Well, again, there's a general formula. If you choose any two elements A and B in a Jordan algebra, then again, there's a corresponding derivation, DAB, which is given as follows. You take the anticommutator of A and B with your element, and then you subtract the same thing, but with B and A swapped. Okay, so there's a general theorem that if you have any algebra that satisfies the axioms of a Jordan algebra, then you take any two elements, B and A, and you first, you know, here this says you first take the product of your element X with B, and then you take the result of that and take the product with A, and then you subtract the same thing, but with B and A swapped. That's what a general derivation for a Jordan algebra looks like. And the final point is that now when we applied those to our algebras, then in the norm division algebra case, what we find is that for the real numbers, the derivation algebra is zero. There are no derivations. Same with C. With the quaternions, we get SU2. And with the octonions, we got G2. Now, when we move down to the Lie algebras, well, the Lie algebras are their own derivations. The Jacobi identity says that if you apply the derivation formula that we just wrote down for Lie algebras to a Lie algebra, well, every element in the Lie algebra is a derivation of itself. So the derivation algebra is the same as the Lie algebra, or at least the algebra of inner derivations. And finally, for the Jordan algebras, for J spin N, the corresponding derivations end up being, spin N, the double cover of SON, the way that spinners transform under n-dimensional rotations in Euclidean space. For HN, sorry, is this too small to see? For HN, we get SON. For HNC, for the real Hermitian matrices, we get SON as their automorph, as their derivation algebra. For the n by n complex matrices, we get SUN. For the n by n quaternionic matrices, we get SQN, so all of the classical families from above. And for H3O, we found at the end last time that we get F4. Okay. So we get all of the classical Lie algebras, and then so far we've met for the first two of the exceptional Lie algebras, G2 as the symmetries of the octonions, and F4 as the symmetries of the exceptional Jordan algebra. And now let me just briefly say, so you know, we saw last time that in analogy with here, where we have the Hermitian n by n matrices over the real complex and quaternions. In the Lie algebra case, what we have is the set of, this is really just the, SON is really the set of anti-Hermitian real elements, anti-Hermitian n by n matrices with real elements, anti-Hermitian n by n matrices with complex elements, and anti-Hermitian n by n matrices with quaternionic elements. And in this case, actually, it's in the complex case, it's the traceless part. Okay, and so we think that this is supposed to be something about, we expect from this pattern that the complex, that the five exceptionally algebras should be something about the Octonians. And for the first two cases, it turns out to be true. And I'll just tell you now what geometrically, I'll just flash ahead, is give an incomprehensible statement about what the other four are supposed to be according to the magic square. So the magic square ends up interpreting the remaining four exceptionally algebras, F4, E6, E7, and E8, as the following, as the symmetries of the following space, that we take the Octonians tensor, any one of the four remaining norm division algebras K. So K could be R or C or H or O. And we take the projective plane built over that tensor product of two algebras. And the idea is that when we take K equals O, its symmetries are F4. When we take K equals C, the symmetries are E6. When we take K equals H, the symmetries are E7. And when we take K equals O, the symmetries are E8. Okay, so as I said, that's probably incomprehensible at the moment. So let me try to build up to it. But that's where I want to go today and give you the explanation of how you actually construct those algebras and the kind of geometric intuition. And then next time I want to. Well, we'll see if we make it to triality at the end. If we don't, then that'll probably be the beginning of the next lecture. But then I want to. Then we'll have all the ingredients in place to begin talking about the application to the standard model. And the math blitz will be, hopefully largely behind us. I know there's a lot of there's a large mathy interlude here just to get to the point. So how do we get to this formula we wanted for the magic square and to that intuition that I just mentioned? Well, for starters, an important point, you know, somehow the way people, so the for starters, the key thing to understand is that there are a whole bunch of key results that hold for the first three norm division algebras. For arbitrary n, so if you consider n by n matrices over these first three norm division algebras, for arbitrary n, there are some well-known formulas that are sort of underlie the Lie groups and Lie algebras and Jordan algebras we know and love. And the key point is that those extend very nicely to the case where K is the Octonians, as long as we take N is equal to 3, as long as we only consider 3x3 matrices. And often the identities are rather easy or trivial to show when for the first three norm division algebras, but then the fact that they extend to the Octonian case often looks like a bit of a miracle, or it's in any case quite non-trivial that it works. And so let me tell you the key examples that I mean, the most important examples, sorry. And some of these, I was just discussing with Gong, we haven't decided exactly what problems to put on the problem set or which ones to keep be the required problems versus maybe optional problems. But in one way or another, some of these will be on there. So in the following, let's let X, Y, and Z denote Hermitian matrices with elements in K. Okay, so those are elements of the n by n Hermitian matrices over K. And let A and B denote n by n anti-Hermitian matrices with elements in K. Okay, so they're elements of A n of K. Okay, and then let's do one other thing. So let's say DAB is the derivation. On this page, DAB will denote the derivation of the norm division algebras. And so if we look back, so again, that's this derivation up here, this formula. So what I want to do now is I want to define an object D capital A capital B, which is a sum. Okay, so here is the idea is if you give me two matrices, in fact, let me call this, they don't have to be anti-Hermitian matrices for this definition to hold. So let me call these M and N. So if you give me two matrices, M and N, whose elements are in the division algebra K, I'm going to define the following object, the sum over all I and J from 1 to N of the derivation whose elements are the ijth component of M. So this derivation, you know, it has two arguments. The first argument will be the ijth component of the matrix M, and the second argument will be the jith component of the matrix N. Okay, so in other words, it's like, you know, if you were taking a trace, if you were taking the trace of M times N, that would be exactly Mij times Nji summed over I and J. So it's like we're doing exactly that, but instead of taking the trace of those two matrices, we're taking those things as the two arguments. You know, instead of directly multiplying the elements of those two matrices, we're taking those two factors as the two arguments of this derivation, and then we're performing the sum over I and J. Okay.
Just a question, yes. Nathan.
Yes.
So it's D is still acting on K, right? It's
exactly. So this is a derivation. This is a derivation that takes a vector in the norm division algebra K and maps it to another vector in the norm division algebra K because it's just a sum of a bunch of such derivations. Exactly.
Okay. Okay, thanks.
Okay. So what are these important results that carry over to this special case where from the general case when we have R, C, and H to the special case of N equals 3 when K is O? Well, one that we saw already is the Jordan identity. Okay, we saw that an algebra is a Jordan algebra if it doesn't matter which way we put the parentheses on this expression. And that's true. That's a first example that extends, as one can check. And so that's why the exceptional Jordan algebra is an example of a Jordan algebra. Okay, and then another thing that we discussed last time, which also extends, is that if we take, you know, if we start with the product of X and Y, which I'll here write as the commutator, even though that differs from the product by a factor of 2. So if we take the product of X and Y, and then we take the commutator with A, that the commutator with A acts like a derivation. So in other words, what that means here is that if we first take the commutator with X, that's equal to first taking the commutator with X and then taking the anti-commutator with Y plus first taking the commutator with Y and then taking the anti-commutator with X. Okay. Now there's two more which I want to mention, which are important, and they are the following. So now, this shows that it's a Jordan algebra. This shows that that the quantity CA, the commutator with respect to A. So in other words, this operator A comma blank. Let me just define that. Let me rename that operator C sub A. That'll sometimes be a helpful notation. So this identity is saying that C sub A is a derivation of the Jordan algebra. And then now let's take the commutator of CA and CB to see what the Lie algebra looks like for these derivations. And okay, so if we take that corresponds to, we take the commutator with A and then the commutator with B of an element in the algebra. And then minus, first we take the commutator with B and then we take the commutator with A with the algebra. Okay, and so that turns out to be equal to, well, if it was just ordinary matrices, that would be equal to first taking the commutator with A and B, which gives us yet another, for ordinary real or complex matrices, that would give us another traceless anti-Hermitian matrix. In this case, it gives us an anti-Hermitian matrix, but once we start using quaternions and octonions, it's not necessarily traceless. So the normal expression would be that this is equal to this, but the expression, which is still true for in all the normal cases, but extends to the octonion case, does not look like this. Instead, what we do is we take the traceless part of this matrix, which I'll denote by putting a prime on it. So we subtract the trace from A commutator B. And then we add to it 1 over n times the quantity I mentioned above, d of AB. Okay, so what this is saying is that if we take the commutator first with B and then with A, and then we subtract the commutator first with A and then with B, that is equal to another commutator of the matrix with AB commutator, that's equal to this commutator. So it's another commutator with a traceless anti-Hermitian matrix. But then there's a second term which comes in, which is just this derivation DAB goes and just acts component-wise. It goes into each component of the matrix X. Sorry, so it acts on X, sorry. So this operator DAB goes into, and each component of X is an element of the norm division algebra. And now this derivation D of A and B comes in and hits each element, each component of X separately. Okay? And so that's how the commutator works. So we find that the Lie algebra, so this is really saying that if we look at the Lie algebra generated by these commutators with anti-Hermitian matrices, so it may be that CA is a derivation, but now when we take the commutator of CA and CB, we get a derivation which doesn't have the same form as the original one. It's not just a commutator. This part is a commutator. This is a commutator with this equation is saying that CA commutator CB is equal to the commutator with AB prime. And if that was all it was, the Lie algebra would close. But there's this extra piece, the derivation piece that comes in. And so for that reason, we're finding that the Lie algebra is bigger than just the commutator Lie algebra. Okay, so that's what this equation is saying, and we'll get back to this in 1 second. And then finally, the final important equation, which generalizes, is, so let's look at the equation for a Jordan derivation. So we said that a general Jordan derivation was obtained by taking two elements of the algebra, let's call them X and Y, and forming this operator where first we take the anti-commutator with Y on our arbitrary object, and then we anti-commute with X, and then minus the thing where we swap the two, where we swap X and Y. Okay, so that's what a normal derivation looks like. That's what a general derivation looks like for Jordan algebra. So let's take the derivation and act it on some element z. Okay, so then now the equation is, it looks quite similar to the above equation. The first term we get is where if we now take the commutator of x and y, and then take the commutator with z. So again, if we were dealing with ordinary matrices over the real numbers or the complex numbers, that would be all there was. That would be the whole answer. But now, in this case, to make it generalize, the way we have to write it is that, again, we take the traceless part of x commutator y, and we add exactly the same thing as before, 1 over n dab x. Okay, so what this equation, this last equation, is saying...
Jason, it can't be a, b, and x.
Oops, sorry, thank you. Sorry about that. Thank you, Gon. What I meant to say is it's d of x, y, and z. Okay, so what this equation is now saying is that if we look at the arbitrary derivation of a Jordan algebra over here, what is it equal to? Well, it consists of two parts. There's this first part. Sorry, I'm running out of space on my whiteboard here. I can't write one. So maybe I'll write it over. So if we look at this general derivation of a Jordan algebra, well, it consists of two parts. There's a first part, which is a commutator, which comes from taking a commutator with a traceless anti-Hermitian matrix. And then there's a second part, which is a derivation of K, which comes in and acts element by element in the Jordan in the Jordan matrix Z. And that's all there is. Those are the only two parts. Okay, so that's saying that the general derivation, that last equation is telling us that the general derivation of the Jordan algebra HN, the HN of K is, again, the notation for the Jordan algebra, which is consists of the Hermitian N by N elements, N by N matrices with elements in K. And what that last equation is telling us is that the derivation algebra, if we regard it as first as a vector space, consists of two parts. It's the direct sum of the n by n traceless, this prime always means traceless, matrices with elements in K. So that's one part of the vector space. But then there's an additional part, which consists of the derivations of K. Okay, so the last equation on the previous slide told us that this is the general formula for this derivation algebra for what its vector space is, but now I still need to tell you what the product is on that vector space to make it into a Lie algebra. So let's say we call, so a general derivation now will consist of some C sub A drawn from this part of the algebra, some element C sub A, I'll call that a general vector in this part of the vector space, and then some derivation D drawn from this part of the vector space. And so the question is, what I want to say now is you know, what if we took two elements D and D prime from the second part of the vector space, the derivation of K part, what would a commutator from that be? And then, or what if we took one element from the derivation of K part of the vector space and one element from the first part of the vector space, what would that commutator be? And then what if we took both of our elements from the first part of the vector space? What would their commutator be? So if we took two elements C and B, C sub A and C sub B, what would their commutator be? So these first two things one can easily check. If you just do this, if you just take two of these elements D and D prime drawn from the derivations of K and they just act element-wise, well, you can show that they just form a sub-algebra. That when you take their commutator, you get another element D prime, and they just obey the same algebra that they did when you know, if we were just considering derivations of K by itself, whatever Lie algebra that was, that's exactly the Lie algebra that governs this first commutator. The derivations just commute and give a linear combination of one another, the derivations of K. So when we take the commutator of two derivations of K which act element-wise, we just get the corresponding third derivation of K that we would get in the ordinary Lie algebra. And again, it just acts component-wise on the elements of the Jordan algebra. Meanwhile, here, something that will be at least an optional check on the homework will be that in this case, what you get in the second case here, the second commutator, if you take the commutator of a component-wise derivation of K and a commutator with A, what you get is another commutator of dA. Okay, so you get the result is just the commutator with a new traceless anti-Hermitian matrix, which is the matrix we get by taking our original matrix A and component-wise applying D to it. Okay, and finally, if we look at our previous slide, this second expression, again, is exactly the expression for CA commutator CB. So what it is saying, is that CA commutator CB is the commutator with the commutator whose argument is the commutator of A and B, and then plus 1 over n times the component-wise derivation dAB. Okay, so this is the general form for the Lie algebra for any Jordan algebra HN of K. And so now, just by a simple generalization of this, gives the magic square Lie algebra. But maybe before I say that, maybe this is a good time to stop and ask, does Gong have a, last time I didn't let her give her Gong?
Yes, here.
Should I unshare my screen?
Sure.
What is it? How visual is what you're going to do?
The visual part is only this.
Okay.
This is a piece of an instrument.
Hold on, I'm unsharing. Give me no. Actually, if I unshare, I think it erases it. So maybe I won't unshare.
Okay, I'll just put it really close to the camera. It's a piece of an instrument.
Oh, actually, I find if I double click on your picture, I can enlarge it. So in case anyone,
in case everybody wants to say it bigger, it's an instrument that it goes onto the nose. That is called a nose flute. My main instrument is a flute.
But do you play
somehow, I encountered this piece of instrument. Like one of my past students have one. They'll be like, yes, I have to get this thing.
That looks so great.
The tone is completely off. Also, Robert somehow doesn't like it, so. But I hope at least Latham would recognize the melody because it's more kids related. Basically, it's the very first piece my flute teacher assigned me to play because it only involves three notes.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm very nervous and it's...
No, you're doing... I've already heard three notes, but how are you making different notes? I don't get it.
Somehow it involves like you are able to breathe your nose when you open your mouth. Apparently it's not everybody can.
I see, and you're kind of changing your tongue position to change the note?
Yeah, but changing how much air is in my mouth.
Right,
changing it's like the volume of my face. So my tuning is never right.
You're blowing my mind, you know, because actually my mother got me a nose flute when I was a kid, but I always thought it could only play one note. I never learned to play more than one note, so I got bored with it. It's amazing, Gong. Thank you. That was perfect.
Again, great job. That was good.
I hope you are entertained.
Gong, I'm bringing nose flute right after the class. Okay. Thank you. That was amazing. Okay, so let's on the next slide now try to just give a little bit of motivation, and then the idea is that we're going to write down a formula for the general Lie algebra, the magic square Lie algebra, which is exactly modeled on this one, but will just be a slight generalization of it. Sorry. Okay, so to explain how to generalize it, I first want to explain what, so I was talking before about the projective plane over such and such a space. So let's talk about projective spaces for a moment. Okay, so for any of our norm division algebras, well, for R, C, when K is R, C, or O, or H, then you can define a projective space by the n-dimensional projective space is defined by as the space where, okay, you start with vectors in K n plus 1. Okay, so these are vectors which have n plus 1 components, each of which is a element of K. Okay, so we have x1 through xn plus 1, where let's say we're dealing with the quaternions, you know, these are n plus 1, this is a vector with n plus 1 components, each of which is a quaternion. And then we'll declare two, okay, say we have one element, whoops, I'm at risk of leaving the meeting here. Say we have one element K, which is in this space, and then let K be a vector in this vector space. Then we'll declare that to be equivalent to another vector, which is can be expressed as K times a quaternion X zero. Okay, so in other words, if two vectors in the n plus one dimensional space are related by overall multiplying every component of one vector by the same quaternion x zero, then we'll declare those two vectors to be equivalent. Okay, so we're taking every ray in the vector space, every kind of line through the origin, if you want, and declaring that whole line to be a point in the projective space. Okay, so that effectively subtracts one dimension from the space because we're modding out by this one dimension, this number x, this quaternion x zero. And so what we end up with is an n-dimensional space called the projective n space over KPN. So, you know, what you can think of is that, you know, in the real case, it's easiest to visualize. Let's say we started with three real dimensions, and then so we have our three-dimensional real space, we have these three axes, and we can consider any line through the origin. And it intersects the sphere at two points here. Okay, so we can think of, in this case, we're going to take this whole line and interpret it as a point. So we can think of it as being this point But it's also this point. So every line, of course, pierces the sphere in two points. We want to interpret it as one point. So you can think of the projective space that we get here, which we would call RP2, the real projective plane, as the set of points on the sphere, as long as we identify each point on the sphere, like this one, with its antipodal point, because we want it to be the same, ultimately the same point. Okay, so these are, you know, if you look at like what are the most important spaces that turn up in mathematics, I mean, what are the most important n-dimensional manifolds? Well, there's basically n-dimensional Euclidean space, there's the n-dimensional sphere, which is the positively curved space, the n-dimensional hyperbolic plane, which is the negatively curved space, and then these projective spaces are the other basically most important spaces that turn up in math. And where a lot of algebraic geometry, for example, takes place. And it turns out that this space KPN is really equivalent to the Jordan algebra. I should say KPN minus 1 is equivalent to the Jordan algebra HN of K. Okay, so for example, and so the equivalence maybe is not super important to say here. I can explain it. Well, anyway, for the sake of time, I'm not going to explain it right here. But the basic idea is that, you know, if you have any element in this Jordan algebra which squares to itself, okay, so where any element E such that E squared equals E, that's an idempotent element or a projection operator. So that's an element where, you know, in the real or complex case, you can think of it as a matrix whose eigenvalues are all 0 or 1. And depending on how many eigenvalues are 1, you say that the rank is such and such. So if it's a matrix that has 1 eigenvalue, which is 1, and the rest are zeros, you say it's a rank 1 projection operator. If it has 2 eigenvalues, which are 1, and the rest are 0, you say it's a rank 2 projection operator. So the idea is that the rank k projection operators over here correspond to the k minus 1 dimensional objects over here. So the rank 1 projection operators in the algebra correspond to the points in this space. The rank 2 projection operators in the algebra correspond to the lines in this space, the projective lines. The rank 3 projection operators correspond to the planes over here. And anyway, it turns out that they're really identical to each other. But in the Octonian case, just as always, so by this identification, we get a projective plane also defined, right? I didn't mean to put it. We get a projective plane also defined for the Octonians. So really there's two projective objects we can form for the Octonians, OP1 and OP2. And again, then the game stops because in the Octonian case, we're not allowed to let n get bigger than 3. And this object here, OP2, was actually was a previously known mathematical object. It was known to be this very remarkable object called the Mufang plane, discovered by Ruth Mufang in the early part of the century, before the discovery, or at least almost exactly at the same time as the exceptional Jordan algebra was discovered, but for completely different reasons having to do with projective geometry. That's what a projective n space is. Now, you know, you see the key thing here when I was defining a projective n space was that I identified two points along a ray by if they were related by an arbitrary element, But in order for this relation to be symmetric, you know, I could alternatively write this relation as, you know, as the first point is 1 over x naught, k is equivalent to another point k. And so it looks like the division algebra property is important. The fact that we can, you know, the key point about division algebras is that you can not only multiply elements, but divide them. And that looks like an important part of defining a symmetric, an important part of defining what a projective plane is. It is an important part. Okay, nevertheless, in the 50s, this guy Boris Rosen, I always get mixed up about what his last name is, actually. What is his last name? I've lost it. Rosenfeld had this kind of brilliant idea. He assembled a bunch of bits of evidence that, in some sense, the four exceptional Lie algebras F4, E6, E7, and E8, everything except for G2. He had this idea that in some sense they should correspond, like I said before, to R tensor O, the projective plane defined over that. So in other words, now here K, instead of being an element in this space, we imagine that K is an element, you know, we take the space of three component vectors where each component is valued in R tensor O, or each component is valued in R tensor C. Or R tensor H or R tensor O. And we define the projective plane over that in analogous fashion. Well, there's something funny about that definition. It doesn't really make sense mathematically, because once we take the tensor product of R with C, I misread here. So what I wanted to say was that these four exceptional Lie algebras correspond to, Rosenfeld had various bits of evidence that he accumulated that they corresponded in some sense to spaces that were like R tensor O, the projective plane, or C tensor O, or H tensor O, or O tensor O. Now, he couldn't really define these projective planes and make his idea concrete because, as I was saying, R tensor O, well, R tensor O is a division algebra, it's just equivalent to O, but H tensor O and O tensor O are not division algebras. So you can't really define the projective plane. No one's really figured out how to do it yet. But as I say, he accumulated a bunch of bits and pieces of kind of numerological evidence, and that led to the discovery of the magic square Lie algebra, where people, even though they couldn't construct the projective plane itself, they could guess what the symmetries of the projective plane would be by analogy with how you construct the symmetries of an ordinary projective plane. And those symmetry algebras did indeed turn out to be the right ones. They turned out to be F4, E6, E7, and E8. And that's the so-called magic square construction. So it's a bit of there's a lot that's still mysterious about it, really. But let me tell you how the construction goes. So let's look back for one more time here at our previous expression, because we're going to try to generalize it. So if we look at the top line, we had that the derivation of HNK, okay, which again corresponds to the space KPN-1, that you know what, I should say something here, which I didn't properly explain, is that So if we're in this relationship between, if we look at this relationship between the projective space on one side and the Jordan algebra on the other side, one part of that relationship is that the symmetries of the Jordan algebra, the automorphisms on this side, by the correspondence end up being the symmetries of the manifold on the other side. So the, over here we have the so-called isometry group of KPN minus one, the symmetries of the manifold. And similarly, if we take the leap here, so, and then if we take the, since we can't really construct the manifold itself in any global sense for Rosenfeld's cases, we can't really get the full, it's not really, no one really knows how to deal with the full isometry group of the manifold because we don't have the manifold itself. So instead we deal with the infinitesimal generators of the automorphisms on one side, so those are the derivations, and of the isometry group on the other side. And so going back to our previous expression, that's exactly what we had. We had the derivations of HNK, which according to this are also the infinitesimal generators of the isometries of this manifold KPN minus one. And they had these two pieces, an antisymmetric commutator piece and a piece that just acted component-wise as a derivation on the elements of the matrix. And so now what we're going to do in the magic square is we're just going to, and with the Lie brackets given by this formula, and for, so now in the magic square, we're basically going to act as if we're just replacing K by K1 tensor K2 here. Okay, so so what that'll mean is that now we'll have in the magic square, instead of the antisymmetric matrices over K, we'll have the antisymmetric traceless matrices with elements in K tensor in K1 tensor K2. And instead of having the derivations of K, we'll have the derivations of K1 plus the derivations of K2. Okay, so let me just write that on a different slide to make it a bit neater. So the idea is that this was discovered then later than Rosenthal by a very fascinating fellow named Hans Freudenthal, great mathematician. So we pick any two Lie algebra. We pick any two norm division algebras now, K1 and K2. We're going to take their tensor product. And now we want to construct the Lie algebra that sort of would correspond to the projective plane. We want to construct the, whoops. Can you guys still see the screen? What did I? No. I've lost my Zoom page. Are you guys all still there?
I can hear you.
Yep, I can hear you too.
I can see a whiteboard.
Oh, okay. I think I'm back here.
Save your point.
Okay, I'm back. Sorry. It took a while for my screen to refresh. So we're trying to construct what the Lie algebra would be for K1 tensor K2, its projective plane. And so the idea is that the magic square construction, okay, really Freudenthal and Titz wrote down a version of this, but not the most elegant version. So the later construction by this guy Vinberg gave a more elegant presentation. So I'm going to give that first. And then there was a later, even more elegant construction in terms of triality by Pierre Raymond, which I'll explain later. Probably it'll be in the beginning of the next lecture. Okay, so let's look at the, this Lie algebra is going to have three components, like we were just saying. First, it's the antisymmetric traceless matrices whose elements are now elements of K1 tensor K2, and then plus a piece which are the derivations of K1, and then plus a piece which are the derivations of K2. And so let's call an element again in this part of the algebra, CA. And then let's call an element in this part of the algebra, D. Okay, so D is an arbitrary derivation, which is a sum of a derivation of K1 and K2. But again, it's going to act component-wise on the matrices, whereas CA is going to be we're going to take an arbitrary anti-Hermitian matrix with elements in K1 tensor K2 and act by commutator on something. Okay, and so so I just need to tell you what the Lie bracket looks like now for these pieces. So if I take the commutator of two of these derivations, D and D prime here, well, it's just like before. This whole thing forms a Lie subalgebra. So the commutator of two elements D and D prime just gives me a third element D double prime in the same subspace, so which again just acts as a derivation component wise on the algebra. Okay, so this is if we take the commutator of a derivation with CA, an element of from the first part of the algebra, well, it's exactly the same as before. That is just going to be given by C of the derivation acting on the derivation acting component wise on A. And then finally, if we take CA with CB, two elements from the first part of the algebra, well, again, that's going to look a lot like the previous expression. Okay, so far this is exactly the same as the previous expression. Where again, D of AB, I remind you, is defined as the sum over I and J. Okay, but now I need to tell you what this guy is, because see, now we're no longer, now an element, the element Aij of the matrix A is no longer a member of a norm division algebra. It's a member of the tensor product of two norm division algebras. Okay, so the formula for the derivation of the tensor product of two norm division algebras is different, but it's just given as follows. So if we have two elements, so suppose we have two elements now, A, which is an element of the tensor product, so this is some, it's an element A1 tensor, and A1 from the first, from A1 and K1 tensor with A2 and K2, and it actually might be the sum of various such elements, but let's just consider one for simplicity. And then and another element B, which is again an element of the tensor product, so it's has this form B1 tensor B2. So then the derivation of K1 tensor K2 is, well, we take two elements like this, two elements A and B, and the corresponding derivation A comma B now has two terms in it. Okay, the first term is where we take I'll call this new kind of derivation D hat to different from the old D. Okay, so the new derivation D hat of AB is, there's a first term where we take the inner product of A1 with B1. Okay, so these are both two vectors in the same vector space, and we can just take their normal Euclidean inner product. And then we take the times the old derivation, previous derivation d of a2 b2, and then plus a second term, which is just sort of the other possibility, where we take the inner product of a2 with b2, and then take the old derivation whose arguments are a1 and b1. Okay, and so there you have it. What happened is that people came up with this guess for this not guess. It's what the automorphism. It's what the symmetry group Lie algebra of isometries of this projective plane would be if it existed, even though it doesn't really exist, or at least people haven't figured out how to properly define it yet. But nevertheless, they could write down this Lie algebra, and then you can make a little table now for different choices of K1 and K2. Of what the Lie algebra you should get when you
May I ask a question?
Yes.
So this new d hat is acting on K1 tensor K2, right?
Exactly. It's just like before. It's acting component wise. It's acting component wise on each element of a matrix. And so when it goes in, this part comes in and just acts on the K1 part of the vector space, leaving the K2 vector space alone. So this first part is just an operator that maps K1 to K1 while leaving the K2 component of the tensor product alone. And then plus another term which comes in and just acts on the K2 part of the vector space while maps it to itself while leaving the K1 part alone.
Okay.
Wait. Lesum, is it the first part acting on the K2 and the second part acting on K1?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Sorry. Thank you. Thank you, Gong. I said it backwards. Yes. This first term, this first term, this first derivation acts on the K2 part. Thank you. Yes. And the second term, I said it backwards.
Thanks.
Okay, so yeah, so let's say this is a little table here with our algebras K1 and K2 here. So this gives rise to the so-called magic square. In the three by three case, if we take n equals three, we think about the projective planes defined over K1 tensor K2. So I won't fill in the whole square. You get a Lie algebra in each case, but you know the key point is that in the final row here, I should write these lowercase. These are the Lie algebras. We get F4, E6, E7, E8. And then of course G2 is just the derivations of the Octonians themselves. So this is the best. That people have come up with in terms of a sort of a geometric a sort of understanding of what the exceptional Lie algebras are about and how they relate to the Octonians. So on the homework, another suggested problem will be that you can use the formula on the previous page to calculate what the dimensions of the Lie algebras are. In this case, that's a very quick thing to do, and you can check that for each of these combinations, you do count up the correct dimensions here, by just let me just give a slight sketch of what that would be like. So let's say we took the case of let's try that exercise for the case where we take the Lie algebra constructed by the magic square construction for let's say H and O. Okay, let's see that would be this element. We want to see that the Lie algebra has the right dimension here. Okay. So let's first figure out what would be the dimension of the 3x3 traceless matrices whose elements are elements of H tensor O. Well, so here we have, if we consider a 3x3 matrix, there's three off diagonal elements above the diagonal. Okay, so let's so we have three diagonal elements, and for an anti-Hermitian matrix, those three elements will all be the imaginary elements, and then we have three off diagonal elements in the upper column, and then three off diagonal ones below, but these ones will not be independent because the three in the upper column, once we've chosen those, the ones in the lower column are just the conjugates of those. So let's first start with these three off diagonal elements on top. Well, each of those is an element of H tensor O. H is a four-dimensional algebra. O is an eight-dimensional algebra. So each of those elements is a four times eight-dimensional vector. And then there's three of those upper diagonal elements. So that's three times four times eight. So I think that's 96. And then, okay, so then what about along the diagonal? Well, each diagonal element is an imaginary element of H tensor O. So let's first talk about what do I mean by an imaginary element of K1 tensor K2? You know, if I take an element of K1 tensor K2 and I take its conjugate, what I mean is I'm just taking the conjugate of both elements separately, tensoring those. Okay, and so if we think about, you know, an element that was maybe a combination of I drawn from the quaternions and an imaginary, you know, E6 drawn from the octonions, well, under conjugation, both those elements would separately pick up a minus sign, so their tensor product wouldn't pick up a minus sign. So the tensor product of two imaginaries is actually a real element of the tensor it doesn't pick up an imaginary under conjugation. So what we want to get an imaginary element in the tensor product, which is what will lie along the diagonal here, what we want is a tensor product of a real element from K1 and an imaginary from K2, or vice versa. So how many of those will there be? Well, there's one real element in K1 times seven real elements in K2. There's one, so in H times O, there's one real element in H times seven imaginary elements in O, plus one real element in O times three imaginary elements in H. So there's, by my count, 10 imaginary elements in H tensor O. So this is 10-dimensional, this is 10-dimensional, and because of the trace condition, this is not independent. So we take our 96 and we have to add 10 plus 10 to it. Okay, so by my count, this first part of the algebra is 116-dimensional. And then, hope I'm not gonna screw this up. And then now, I'm totally screwing this up. What's going wrong? Oh, maybe not. And then we have the derivations of H. So those are SU2. So that's a three-dimensional Lie algebra. And then we have the derivations of O, which is a 14-dimensional Lie algebra. So if we add up 116, 3, and 14, do we get 133? Yes, we do. So that's anyway, it's just a little check to show, it's not really actually checking that this is the Lie algebra E7, although once you knew it was a simple Lie algebra, that would be enough to prove that it was E7, because E7 is the only simple Lie algebra with 133 dimensions, but we haven't proved simplicity. But anyway, it's still a worthwhile check to make sure you understand what's going on. Okay, where am I time-wise? Oh, I'm like way over time-wise, my God. Wait. Yeah, I'm way over time. I'm sorry. I completely lost track of time. Sorry about that, everyone. So that's what the magic square is. I'll, at the beginning of the next lecture, I'll just explain that there's been an even more elegant reformulation in terms of triality. And one of the given by Raymond of what's going on here. And I'm interested in that because I want it to be related to why there are three generations in the standard model. Anyway, I'll cut it off there.